Meeting of the House Civil Law Committee is called to order. Do I have a motion on the minutes?
So moved.
Minutes have been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Atkins, are you prepared on House File 450? I will move House File 450 to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and thank you particularly to the Chair and the CA for scheduling, in spite of the pain that it may cause, two Atkins bills back-to-back. It's a very kind and gracious move, Mr. Chairman. This is a very well-intended effort was made back in 2007 to deal with some issues relative to statute of limitations, statute of repose. I know members of this committee are familiar with those, but we were in an effort to deal with an issue that arose. We made some fixes, and as sometimes happens in this place, the fix actually was worse than the original problem. The statute of limitations in improvement to real property cases is 2 years. The statute of repose is 10 years. And what we were encountering several years back, 5-6 years ago,
if you could, Representative Atkins, if some new members of the committee, could you briefly describe what those are?
I'm happy to, Mr. Chairman. The statute of limitations, and both have a good purpose. Statute of limitations, statute of repose, basically are so that you can't, there's a limitation on the amount of time that an injured party has in which to bring their claim. And the goal of that is that you don't want to have it get so far out, 20, 30 years or something like that, where it's hard to go back and find the appropriate evidence to really attain the truth and figure out what actually happened. So in Minnesota, in various types of claims, we have anywhere from a 2-year statute of limitations upwards to a 6-year statute of limitations in which a party has to bring their claim. I'll try to use a real-world example that's fairly simple. Most of these cases are a little bit more complex than this, but let's say you got a set of steps and somebody falls down. They got 2 years because that's an improvement to real property case, and it's due to the design of the steps. It's not because there was ice or some other negligence, but it was the steps were poorly designed. So you've got your 2 years in which to bring your claim, and if you wait 2 years and 1 day, you can't bring that claim. We also have, that's the statute of limitations. The statute of repose is that if you get towards, you get 8 years, 9 years after those steps were originally constructed, you've got, there's a 10-year statute of repose, which means even though you've, let's say you're 9 years out and you fall as a result of this poorly designed set of steps, you fall down, you're still capped at that statute of repose time period. So you got a period of time, but you've got to still bring it within the statute of repose. What we attempted to do is that we had some folks that were discovering a case or a claim or having a problem 9.5 years deep after the steps were originally constructed. And we wanted to make sure that they had their 2 years, even though it was beyond that 10-year statute of repose. So we allowed for that to occur. And then there was something called contribution and indemnity. That is sometimes what happens is if I'm making my claim against the owner of the house or the building where the steps are, they have a right to go against the architect or the engineer, whoever designed those steps in the first place. And as a result of the fix that we tried to do back in 2007, we phrased it in such a way that left open the ability for the contribution indemnity claim against the architect or the engineer, forever. So if you were an architect or an engineer, the way the statute that we passed has been interpreted, literally at this point in Minnesota, even though we've got a 2-year statute of limitations and a 10-year statute of repose, you could go out 20 years, 30 years, 40 years in that claim against an architect or an engineer or somebody else who designed those steps. That was never our intent in 2007, and as you might imagine, and fella down here to the right, who's an architect, you're an architect, right?
Yes.
told you he's an architect. He can't sleep at night anymore because well, he probably can. But we just we shouldn't have these liabilities hanging over. And it was never anybody's intention to make folks try to insure against something that was done 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And so we've under the language that's in the proposal, there's a 14-year under which or 14-year cap under which no claims would be allowed after that. That was what the original effort was designed to do, was to put some limitations on how long people would have. I don't know that I've done the best job of explaining it, but I've got a fellow here to my right that can perhaps further explain it or answer any questions that people may have. But the substance of it is, Mr. Chair and members, is that rather than this unlimited open liability for architects and engineers, we cap that and limit that to the 14-year period. They're in support of it. As far as I know, everybody that was aware and part of the original discussion in 2007 is fine with this fix, and I'd appreciate members' support. With that, I'd turn it over to a couple of testifiers to add a little bit more clarity and answer any questions that members may have.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. First testifier, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Eric Heiberg, and I'm from the law firm of Healy, Duncan, and Molander, and I'm here on behalf of ACEC Minnesota, which is the Association of Consulting Engineers Council, American Consulting Engineers Council. And Representative Atkins did a very nice job explaining the problem, and the problem that engineers have in particular is that the way the statute has been interpreted makes retirement very difficult. As you may know, engineers, when they sign a plan, not only are putting their firm on the line, but they're individually putting themselves on the line. And as a result, the open-ended liability for which they can't buy insurance once they retire is a real concern to them. And so we'd ask for your support of this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Heiberg. Another testifier?
Chair, my name is Eric West. I'm with the American Institute of Architects on the Government Affairs Committee. And I think Representative Atkins and Eric have explained the issue exactly. And it really comes down to an issue of liability and insurance. And in addition to not being able to buy insurance, to in the current state, we're documenting all these things and having to keep all that documentation ad infinitum as well, which has a real cost as well. And so the liability, the insurance, and open-ended, we'd ask your support in passing this bill. I appreciate your hearings.
Thank you. Any other testifiers you have? We have a question from the committee. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I got a couple of questions. This only deals with residential contracting, or does this deal with commercial and residential contracting?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, I didn't bring my copy of the bill with me. I probably should have, but as I understand it, it applies to all, not just, I used a residential example, but... I don't think that's my cell phone causing that. We didn't limit it. The point was to address the problem for all situations. I just happened to use a residential example.
Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make sure. And I guess my question is I want to follow up, is how does residential contracting licensing fall in with this? Does this dovetail with the residential contracting, or how does this fit in with that? And you know, does it also limit the anything to do with building inspections and that type of thing? How does this all tie in with those restrictions and those items?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, and if I've misunderstood what your question is, just follow up with me. But it shouldn't have any impact on them whatsoever. All the laws that are currently in place which they're comfortable with, which they've not raised any concerns about relative to the statute of limitations or the statute of repose, will not have an impact on them. What we're primarily getting at are these contribution and indemnity claims that typically flow to the, and that's why we have an architect here, and the engineers are the ones who are on the back end of these things. They're the ones who end up getting roped in 12 years, 13 years out, or under the way we've got the law right now, 15, 20, 30 years out.
Representative Howe.
And I, Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually agree with that. I think that's the good part of it. I just, you know, with the current licensing and of some subcontractors and contractors in the residential field, I just want to make sure we're not. There's times when a subcontractor, when a contractor finds something insignificant with a subcontractor and then holds his pay and just lays that out and basically hangs that poor subcontractor usually his margins aren't that big anyway and strings him along, and with the downturn in the market and the limited amount of folks that are still in the marketplace and still in the contracting field in that area, they have a hard enough time meeting the bottom line. I just don't want to extend that out another couple of years and make that tougher for them to survive. So if this doesn't play into those folks, I don't have an issue with it.
Representative Atkins, I'm sorry, Mr. Heiberg.
Just to answer your question, this only deals with improvements to real property, defects and improvements to real property. It doesn't affect any of the administrative claims that you had mentioned, and all the lien and collection stuff is not affected by this statute. Those are other statutes.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I'm just wondering how prevalent this is. You said that there are a number of cases that had come forward, regarding the 9.5 year limitation. I'm just wondering how much activity the court can expect to see.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, actually this would lessen the potential for additional cases before the court. Right now we have an open, unlimited period relative to what are called contribution and indemnity claims that would go after the architects and the engineers. So the goal here is to actually close the door at a reasonable level, which is 14 years from the original act, not open ourselves to claims that are, 15, 20, 30 years down the road.
Representative Scott?
And just one more question. The 2007 bill that you addressed, was that an Atkins bill?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. I really can't remember.
Yeah, I bet not. All right, thank you.
Representative Simon.
Just to clarify, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. So this is just for contribution and indemnity, right? So the main claim is untouched by this bill, right? It's still 2 years for the statute of limitations, 10 years for the statute of repose, as I read it, or am I getting the numbers off? Just for the main claim, not the contribution and indemnity.
And
Representative Atkins, thank you, Mr. Chair. If someone has their cell phone on or has a loose filling, can you please shut off your cell phone? Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, it might be simplest to just use it. I think you're exactly right, Representative Simon. Is if you get out your 9 3/4 years post-original act you've discovered that you've been injured, you bring your claim, gets you out to 11 3/4 years the extreme scenario, 11 years, 364 days, make the claim. And the person that wants to bring in the contribution indemnity claims, they bring in the architect, the engineer, some other party into the claim. Right now they would have, or under the proposal, they would have through the end of the year 14. Under current law, the way we unfortunately drafted it in 2007 is they could bring that entity in 15, 16, year 17, 20, and that unlimited unknown liability is driving architects and engineers a little crazy.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Do you have any other testifiers regarding the bill, Representative Atkins?
I do not.
Any members of the public that wish to be heard on House File 450? Seeing none, then Chair renews his motion that House File 450 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I missed where the re-referral was. Where did it go?
To Judiciary, Finance, and Policy, Representative Atkins. Was that your intent?
I was not aware of any impact on Judiciary, Finance.
There was a request from the Chair, Representative Atkins.
All good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
As to your bill, House File 482, Representative Atkins, are you prepared to proceed? Okay, and Representative Atkins, I understand you have an A13-0046 amendment, an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So I'll move that House File 482 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. This was requested by the Chair also, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And as to the... Where's the amendment? House File. Okay. So, amendment, the A13 amendment, in order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires... All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. To your bill as amended, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I presented briefly, I'm going to invite down Mr. Kaufman and Ms. Kingsley to walk you through a couple of scenarios. But 48 other states across the country have a survivorship law. What that means is that if a if an injured person... Let's say somebody gets hurt in a nursing home, in fact, there's a nice map that's been colored in yellow for you. All of the other states in yellow have a survivorship law. Minnesota and Idaho are the two remaining. And why we don't, honestly, I have no idea. But the purpose of a survivorship statute or law is that if you have that person who gets hurt in a nursing home, they suffer and suffer for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and during the pendency of the claim, they die. The general rule is essentially their claim dies with them. So there is this perverse disincentive, and I'm not suggesting that insurance companies do this. I'm just saying that under current Minnesota law, it's actually to the advantage of the insurance company when they have somebody who's 80 years old to wait them out and hope that they die. It's not a good way to have your laws operate to actually incent the insurance companies to try to drag things out in hopes that someone will die. And the reason why that incentive is there is because most of their claim goes away. There's still a little bit left for some actual monetary out-of-pocket kinds of things, but their family is left with almost nothing as far as the claim goes. And there are some, and it's a very rare kind of thing that happens, but when it does, it's absolutely tragic. And so rare that in 20 years of practice, and I think I've had somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 clients, Mr. Chair, I've never had this happen to me in terms of any of my clients passing away. I've had it come close, but I've got a couple of testifiers here who will give you a couple scenarios where it has actually happened. And when it does, it's just absolutely tragic. And that's why we think Minnesota ought to join the other 48 states and just continue to hold wrongdoers accountable and not have claims die out just because somebody passed away. With that, I'll turn it over, I think, first to Ms. Kingsley and then to Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Ms. Kingsley. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Karen Kingsley. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I'm also the president of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I'm here today seeking your support to overturn the existing law and to pass the law that Representative Atkins is proposing. I echo him in that this is a rare instance. I've been practicing 26 years in private practice. I've had this happen twice. And so this isn't a case where, should this pass, there's going to open any floodgates. It's very rare. But the reason we're seeking it is because when it does happen, it's devastating. Representative Atkins mentioned the cases where someone is elderly in a nursing home, and I think Mr. Kaufman will talk about that as well. I've had cases, the two cases I've had, one was an elderly person in a nursing home, but the other one was an older gentleman who was driving his vehicle, and a semi went through a red light, crashed into his vehicle, and smashed him into another semi, so he was wedged between two semis. He obviously sustained significant injuries, and he was living with those injuries for, I think it was over a year, when he died of an unrelated heart attack. So I was dealing with him and you know, finding out about the impact on his life and his family, but when he died, basically his cause of action died. The only thing that would have survived was his out-of-pocket medical expenses, which, frankly, there aren't any attorneys who are going to pursue for that cause alone, because most of that would be paid back to health insurance. It would go to the family in any case. Or if he'd had wage loss in the past, but this was a retired gentleman. So it's rare, but when it does happen, it has a significant impact on the family. I think Mr. Kaufman is going to address what Representative Atkins said about some people dragging out the claim process so that your clients do pass away. There are attorneys in our association who have experienced that, and I think you'll hear briefly about that. It's our belief that this should not have any impact on insurance premiums for the rest of the public, and that's because the insurers are already insuring for this. We all have insurance for automobile accidents. Professionals have insurance for medical malpractice, so those claims are already being covered. This is just for the minuscule number of those claims where someone happens to die when the claim is still pending. And as Representative Atkins pointed out, 48 states do have this. In fact, if you look at our neighboring states, all of them, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, they have laws very similar to exactly what we're requesting that you pass. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kingsley. Mr. Kaufman, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Craig Kaufman. My firm is the Kaufman Law Firm in Rochester. I've never testified in this kind of a situation before, but I have a case in a family that compelled me to notify the association, and they've asked me to appear today. Our client fell 30 feet from an unguarded catwalk. Literally, he was stringing electrical wire and just literally walked off the end of the catwalk, which was not guarded. He suffered a traumatic brain injury, and he's been in a persistent vegetative state since he fell in December of 2011. He was given 6 months to live, which worked out until May of 2012. At that time, he was continued to be monitored by hospital personnel. He had been on a ventilator during that entire time. In August of 2012, the ventilator was removed, but he continues to need the ventilator periodically for congestion and episodes of pneumonia. After the six-month period ran, the family, large family, eight siblings and his mother decided to continue with life support. We became involved in March of 2012. We followed and helped guide the family through the process of deciding to continue with life support. We delayed filing suit, not knowing literally if our client was going to live or to die. The case is now pending. I have several concerns about this that may have been indicated by my comments. One of the things that concerns me is when you talk to a family like this, they just simply don't understand how pain and suffering dies with the individual. It's a significant claim, and I think families feel that simply invalidates the pain and suffering that this person has suffered. I don't know if this is more importantly, but I think what bothers me as a lawyer and what bothers me as a representative of the civil justice system is this is a windfall for the wrongdoer. This is a reward for the wrongdoer. And I think, as Karen says, you see in these cases that the defense often tries to run out the clock. They try to delay the case in whatever way is possible until such time or anticipating such time as the plaintiff will die. We see this in a lot of cases besides just the example that I made. I think in almost every case where we have an elderly client or an elderly plaintiff, you see a slowdown of the procedure. And I think also any time that there's a serious and perhaps terminal health conditions such as cancer may or may not be related to the injury, but it's a situation where there's a significant difference in the value of the claim if the person dies before the claim is finalized. There's a number of procedural problems that are difficult. For example, we face the problem there's different experts that are required for a personal injury case, especially a case like this where there's life care is such a life care and life expectancy or significant issues, those are different experts than we would retain in a claim for death. So there's the possibility of wasted money here too. I'm licensed in both Iowa and Wisconsin. If this incident happened in Winona, if it had happened across the river in La Crosse, or downriver in Clinton or Dubuque, we wouldn't be talking about this. I feel it's a real injustice and a real inconsistency in our progressive legal system, and I would ask the panel to consider passage.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Any questions for members of the committee? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question here. I'm not an attorney, and my legal background is limited. But as I look at this, if you'd clarify something for me, can a claim be filed after someone dies? Let's say 10 years. My wife dies 10 years later. If I think I have a case, can I file a claim? Is there a limitation on when a claim can be filed?
Ms. Kingsley?
Sure. Yes, there's limitations. If it's a wrongful death claim, the statute of limitations in Minnesota is 3 years. If it's a medical malpractice claim, the statute is 4 years unless there's a death involved. Then it's 3 years, and that's assuming it's an adult. There's a lot of caveats with that. If it's an automobile accident claim, the statute of limitations is 6 years. So, yes, in all of these cases, there are very strict statutes of limitations.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as one of the follow-ups to Representative Neuberger's questions, my understanding of this bill was that it was only applicable to cases that had already been filed and were in that were happening, and then the person dies in the middle of the lawsuit. But what you're saying then is that's not correct. Maybe I'm interpreting this wrong, that you can bring an action, begin an action after the person dies. Is that correct?
Are you asking me?
Whoever wants to answer.
Mr. Kaufman.
I'm not exactly sure what your question is, so let me try to answer it this way. Using my case as an example, if we filed the case now, which we have done, it's a personal injury case. The person is alive, and he has the right to claim pain and suffering. If he dies, then it becomes a wrongful death case. And there is no claim for pain and suffering before his death. And that's the significance of the law today.
Okay.
It would allow that claim to go forward. So if this client dies tomorrow, he would still be able to claim his pain and suffering for these last 15 months before.
Scott.
All right, and then if I might.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. And Mr. Kaufman, you mentioned Iowa and Wisconsin have these survivor statutes. Do they have caps on the damages there?
I don't.
Mr. Kaufman.
Pardon me.
Please proceed, Mr. Kaufman.
Mr.
Kaufman, we go through the chair here, so the reason I said that is not to shout at you, but you address the chair and then address the representative.
I didn't mean to
I know.
Violate protocol. I'm going to say Your Honor, but Mr. Chair.
Okay, because
I don't believe so.
Okay,
I don't believe so.
Mr. Chair, I understand that many states do have caps, and I'm wondering, you know, in light of the previous bill that we heard and leaving something open ended, as it was in 2007, and now we're coming back and patching that up and saying there has to be, you know, an end and a beginning here. I just think that maybe, you know, having a cap on such damages would be appropriate, and then. My next question, if I might, Mr. Chair, aren't there right now? You can still get economic damages, correct, for the medical bills and all that stuff. That's a separate action than this one that would include damages for pain and suffering. Is that correct?
That's correct,
Mr. Kaufman.
All right, thank you,
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who wants to take this one, but of the 48 states that have this, how many have no limits?
Ms. Kingsley?
I'm afraid I don't know the exact number. I know that the states around us, I think their laws are very similar to what's being proposed here without limits. I don't know if, and I assume that's information we can get to you. I don't know the exact number.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it seems like we're going from one extreme to the other, and I'd like to have more than a map with 48 yellows. I think a number of them do have different limits, and so I think that we should know kind of where we're, if we're actually going from one end of the spectrum to the other all in one leap. I was curious by the attorney's comment that if we pass this law that his situation would apply. It looks like the effective date is for action of causes of action commenced on or after that date. So is this a situation where we're kind of flipping it, where if you have a wrongful injury and no death, then is it a new case if they die? And are we going to pass this law and then have attorneys hoping that they die so they can file a new claim that has this where they don't have it now? Or
Mr. Carlson, did you want to answer Representative Holberg's initial question?
If I could, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent the Minnesota Association for Justice. And I appreciate the question, Representative Holberg. The issue of caps on damages in general injury cases like we're talking about is actually fairly rare. Most of the caps that we have seen imposed in some jurisdictions are usually just limited to like medical malpractice damages. So they really aren't that common. Many states have found them to be unconstitutional. We had a cap in Minnesota that was imposed in 1985, and it was repealed in 1990 because it didn't do anything. It only punishes those that are most severely injured. And so I can get you kind of a breakdown, but I can tell you just anecdotally. Minnesota, which doesn't have a cap on damages, has the lowest malpractice premiums in the country. So there really isn't, statistically, I can tell you, there isn't really a relationship between caps and insurance premiums or claims. And as to your issue about the effective date, that is a common effective date that we have used, starting with the first time I looked at it was in the changing of the statute of limitations on medical malpractice claims, and it's been fully litigated. There's a case called Goleman versus Northland Physicians, and what that means is that a claim that has not been filed but maybe is, let's say I'm injured today, and I find out 2 years from now what my full damages are, this law would apply. But it does not revive any claim that has been filed. If a claim has been filed and dismissed or somehow adjudicated, it doesn't revive anything. It only is prospective, but it could pick up an injury that happens next month that you don't know about.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I understand all that. My question is if you have a case filed for injury, okay, and then the person dies, do you refile a new case because of the death? In other words, is it a new wrongful death case, or does the injury case, is that the effective date of the claim? Because I mean I heard the attorney here say that if we change this would help his client, but my understanding was that there was already a claim filed. So I'm wondering, does he submit a new claim if and when the person dies, which in a perverse way makes the other side of this equation hoping people die and they can refile a wrongful death as opposed to an injury.
And Mr. Carlson.
Under the new law.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mr. Kaufman address his situation, but his case is filed and pending. And as to what happens when you die, I think Representative Atkins and Ms. Kingsley told you it really depends on what you die from. Mm-hmm. If you die from an injury for a cause unrelated to the injury, that does not convert to a wrongful death case. To convert to a wrongful death case, you actually have to die from the injury that is, that you've sustained prior to your death.
Mr. Chair, I get that. I guess I'm not making myself clear. Right now, this gentleman has an injury case. He doesn't have a wrongful death case because the person hasn't died. If that person were to die related to the injuries that they incurred, is that a new case to file, which then in his situation would apply to the new standard if this bill becomes law, or does just the nature of the original case file change from an injury to a wrongful death?
Who wants to take that one then? Mr. Kaufman.
Well, to answer your question directly, this law would have no effect on the case that I've been describing. If my client dies, the case would be converted to a wrongful death case, but there would be no pre-death pain and suffering.
Representative Hober.
And, Mr. Chair, are you prohibited from refiling as a wrongful death, or because there's already an injury claim, that claim has to stand with the effective date of the original injury claim?
Mr. Kaufman.
I don't know that you're prohibited from refiling. I think the defense would take that position, but I do believe that the effective date, the sort of tolling date, or the date would be the date the first lawsuit was started. In other words, you can't, if you're asking, can you gain a benefit from this, or might this convert to a case that falls under this statute? I don't think that will happen.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and members,
Mr. Carlson,
follow up briefly on that. I think, I'm sorry I don't have the bill right in front of me, but if you notice on in the bill, it'll tell you that a wrongful death action will be handled pursuant to 573.02, which is not in front of you, but that goes through the procedure for converting an injury case to a wrongful death claim. So we do have a procedure in law for appointing of a trustee, personal representative, and there is a procedure in place to do that. It is a conversion of the case.
Representative Holder.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, then a conversion is not a new case.
Right. Representative Scott.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, has a fiscal note been requested? Because I really believe that this will increase court activity. I think people will file more cases.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, with due respect, it won't change the number of cases at all. The number of claimants remains exactly the same. The fact that their claim might be a little bit different, and that their claims for damages may be slightly different than under current law, that could change. But the existence of the number of claims, because we're not increasing the number of potential claimants, that remains exactly the same. This just affects what their claim is for damages.
Representative Portman.
I don't have a question.
You don't? Okay. All right. We have testimony in opposition. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself and proceed for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson. I'm testifying this morning for Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. It's a organization of 50 trade associations and chambers of commerce and 100 individual businesses that collectively represent 64,000 employers in Minnesota. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll kind of focus in on, I think, as the committee has discussed the bill, on maybe the key points from our perspective. And while we oppose the bill, I didn't bring a color chart that state laws, usually when I testify, I'm told to not use other state laws, because in Minnesota we'll decide what our state law is, and that what the sword that cuts both ways. If it's on your side, you cite the 30-plus states. If it's not on your side, you don't cite the other states. But whatever. The point is that I think the key points from Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform perspective is kind of the practical impact and what this change represents. And while X number of states do permit collecting pain and suffering damages in a wrongful death action, we don't. But I think the net effect of that is that in a number of those states, and the chart that I have says 30 states have caps on damages. Our neighboring states, Wisconsin, is $750,000. South Dakota is $500,000. North Dakota is $500,000. Iowa does not have a cap. But we can get a chart, Mr. Chairman, and a graph, I don't have it here today, that gives all of the state caps, whether the cap is across the board cap on non-economic damages. Some are targeted just to medical malpractice. But the point is that a lot of states have caps on damages, I think for the very reason, and the concern that we have is that this clearly will increase the settlement and awards in wrongful death actions in Minnesota. clearly will do that. It's going to bring into wrongful death cases and in the trial. What doesn't happen today is that the experts and the evidence about the nature of and the amount of suffering that an individual incurred, this could be in a car accident. If I'm in a car accident and I see a car coming and, you know, minutes later I'm dead, there's probably a pain and suffering value in that today. That's not part of the trial. That can be part of the trial and likely would be part of the trial if House File 482 is passed. So from our perspective, Mr. Chairman, we think it will have a fiscal impact on the courts in terms of the evidence, the nature of the cases, the amount of money that's going to come under wrongful death actions. And again, we think as you look at the landscape, a lot of states. So we can get a chart. I don't have it here today. I'd hope to have it, to hand it out, to give the committee, and that's clearly we can read the law, get the documents, and show the committee who caps, you know, what they cap in their states. And so I think that is a reasonable way to manage the change in the law, which is going to, you know, which this bill will do, which is to bring pain and suffering damages into wrongful death actions. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the points that I wanted to make this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Looking for questions. In the interim, while people think of questions, do you have examples, Mr. Johnson, you cited that in such cases of near instantaneous death, there was a 30-second period of pain and suffering. Do you have examples of where that was used as pain and suffering damages in any of the other 48 states?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not aware of. I haven't looked at other state actions to see. I'm putting forth the case that we believe is likely to happen because that does happen. So I could try to find out and ask companies that write, my members that write in other states.
Questions for members of the committee? Okay, seeing none then, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any members of the public who wish to be heard on House File 482 as amended? Seeing none, then I've made my motion that House File 482 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Atkins. Members, the next meeting is Wednesday, February 20th at 8:15. That's tomorrow. Thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.